Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
You're listening to Hot Grease, and I'm your host, Nicole Taylor. Today, we'll be talking vegetable literacy. On the phone, we have the author of Vegetable Literacy, Miss Deborah Madison. Deborah, welcome to Hot Grease.
Hi.
Welcome to Hot Grease.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I am so honored to have you on because I definitely consider you a pioneer, an icon in the world of vegetarian food, and really all things food and great cookbooks.
Well, thank you.
So I have a question for you. There's this whole generation, new generation of vegetable lovers and vegetarian bloggers. What do you have to say to them? What would you say to all of them?
Oh, heavens, I don't know. That's a rather wide wide group of people, and everybody is approaching things probably from their own point of view, but which is fine. I think it's great. But I think we've gotten to the point where it's not just about being vegetarian or liking vegetables or thinking they're beautiful or fun to cook with. I mean, for me, I just want to know more about them. Where do they come from? Who are they related to? What do they give us, really? How do they grow? And what happens if we have a garden? I just wanted to get in vegetable literacy a lot more up close to vegetables in the plant world, really stepping away from the market. And so that's what it's about.
Yeah, I look at people, and I know the question probably was very broad, but I'm thinking about, you know, Heidi Swanson and Bryant Terry, who are doing great things around food, and have produced, you know, great books. But your book, The New Vegetable Literacy, is definitely, you know, I'm calling it a definitive for anybody, regardless if you're a meat eater or not.
Well, good. I feel that way, too.
Yes.
After all, we all eat vegetables. We don't have to pick a lifestyle and say we're vegetarian or vegan or this or that. You know, vegetables are part of our world.
So what was your inspiration in writing this new cookbook?
Well, I think really it was having a garden. That was one inspiration because I decided I needed to change my life enough that I could stay home and actually take care of a garden, because you have to be home if you're going to have a garden, or you have to hire somebody to do it, and then you're not doing it, so you might as well not even begin. But being involved with the garden, the frustration, the rewards, the excitement, was in a way one of the inspirations, because I realized there were all kinds of questions I was asking myself from the garden point of view that I would never be able to even ask if I only stayed at the farmer's market or the supermarket. You know, because you're watching plants, you know, do what they do, and they do all kinds of eccentric, wonderful things, and you might ask yourself, you know, gosh, is this edible? Is this not? What's going on here? Also, I do come from a family of botanists, and so, you know, the botanical approach is something that I had long been aware of and was thinking about as well. So that definitely was part of it too.
I always love your cookbooks because, I mean, you don't just get a recipe, you get suggestions, you get the you know, history and the head notes. Was your process in writing this particular cookbook different from the process of any others?
Well, yeah, it was more complicated in some ways because one is I had to do the garden. So, you know, that was exposing myself to something very, very different. And two, I had to do a lot of research. I mean, I had to get those botanical books off the shelf and read them and try to understand them and talk to people and talk with botanists and really inform myself. And this book has much more writing than it has a lot of recipes, but I think when I began, it wasn't necessarily going to have very many recipes, if any. It was really going to be about the plants themselves. But we decided to go for recipes, and I'm glad that we did, because you do want to illustrate what can be done with various things.
Yes, yes. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back and talk more with Deborah Madison. Her latest book is titled Vegetable Literacy. Keep listening. We'll be right back.
Tonight, I just want to hold you.
You're listening to Let It Go by the California Honey Drops on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I ain't looking for no fight. Just let it go now. I ain't looking for no showdown. So won't you open?
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
If you're tuning in live to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network, we are chatting with Deborah Madison. She's the author of 11 cookbooks. Some of my favorite titles are Vegetable Soups, Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone, Seasonal Fruit Desserts. Her latest is titled Vegetable Literacy. So, Deborah, I want to talk a few chapters, some of my favorite chapters in the book.
Okay.
And one being the grass family, in particular,
yeah.
Corn. You really break down what I think a lot of people forget is that there are like different varieties and different forms of corn. Can you just give us like a quick highlight or glimpse into the world of variety and forms of corn?
Well, like any food, there's a lot of variety, but the corns kind of break down into the tender sweet corn, dent corn, flint corn, corns that are suitable for grinding for flours, for polenta, you know, for baking with, and so on and so forth. So they have different appearances and they have different functions. One of the things that has really excited me about corn is cornmeal. And that's because I'm beginning to see it more and more at farmers markets, made from really interesting varieties like red, Floriani corn, which one of our farmers does here. Just an absolutely beautiful flint corn that's red on the outside, yellow-orange on the inside of the kernel, and when this is ground, it has a rich color and a fabulous taste. And it's really fun to cook with these different kinds of corns, especially when they're ground into polenta or cornmeal. They're a little harder to deal with whole unless you have a grinder and you're prepared to do that.
One of the biggest questions I get all the time, it's in terms of what is the difference between polenta and corn grits or regular grits?
Oh, yeah. Well, some people say, hey, polenta is just grits. You know, I'm not sure that there is a big difference. I mean, both are grits in that they're coarse. You know, it's not fine like a flour or a corn meal. You know, I really don't know what the difference is. I was in Italy once and I saw some polenta that a man was selling, and he had ears of his corn. Now, it looked like corn grits to me. It looked like polenta to me. They both take quite a while to cook, 45 minutes or so. But his ears of corn were just absolutely gorgeous. And
yeah, you make a distinction in the book. You basically talk about the way it's ground and the outer kernel of the grits and the corn. But I would say it definitely is the same. It's just a different texture. Mm-hmm. I call polenta Italian grits. It's the same, I feel like, too. Same great taste. You definitely can.
Yeah, I think so, too.
And some of your recipes, I see that you're doing, like, you've done a great corn cookies recipe. And also a buttermilk skillet cornbread. And you also mentioned a second ago, if you don't have a grinder. Do you think people will buy, or people will manufacture little small grinders for folks to have in their kitchen?
I don't have one myself, but I would really like to. Once I'm, sort of back in my kitchen again, that's something I would like to buy. Not a huge grinder, but something that really has a little capacity, because it's not just corn. I mean, all grains, when you grind them yourself and you have them really fresh, are outstanding. They're really good. And by the way, I wanted to say something about those cornmeal cookies. I tried these with freeze-dried corn, which is kind of a food that survivalist types like to buy, or you can take it on camping trips. It's very, very light. And I found that when you grind it, the corn flavor is just outstanding.
It is.
It's absolutely delicious. And so they really gave a lot of corn flavor to that little cookie, which is based on a Venetian cookie, and I like it a lot. But I don't always have it, and when I don't, I use corn flour, and it's just fine, too.
And the buttermilk skillet cornbread with heirloom flint cornmeal. Explain the flint cornmeal. That's kind of in the whole variety category.
Yeah, well, we were just talking about that. It's a hard kind of corn that is intended for baking. Now, it's not sweet corn, for example. And it has to be ground in order to be used. And those are the kinds of corns that people seem to be, farmers seem to be growing and showing up with at farmers markets. Royal Calais and Hopi Blue, the Red Floriani that I mentioned. I even went to a place where a farmer feeds his chickens organic cornmeal, which is very hard to get, by the way, if you're a chicken farmer. And he just ground it up and sold it. Right. And I bought some and took it home. It was delicious. So there you go. It probably had to do with the quality and also the freshness of it.
So, Deborah, for some people who pick up the book or who are listening to the show right now, and when they open the book, they're going to see there's a multitude of recipes and things that they could easily go to their local farmer's market or even their supermarket or even grow themselves. But what advice do you have for folks who are like, oh, my gosh, I can't find this vegetable? I can't grow this. What advice do you have for them in terms of finding this?
Oh, well, that's always the case when you write a book. There are going to be people who don't have access to something because we have a big country. We have very different conditions in it and so forth. But I will say this, although the garden is what inspired me, there are many ways a person can get to a garden. Big cities usually have botanical gardens, and they often have a component like a kitchen garden in them. Farmers markets often give farm tours, and it's how I learned a lot, was going on farm tours and just looking at things growing. I say, gosh, I've never seen rutabagas with their greens. Why is that? Or parsnips with their greens, and there they are in the field. Well, because the farmer tells you they've got to be in the field so many months by the time they're harvested, the greens are really ratty. So you can learn a lot just by talking to people and taking advantage of opportunities that are right probably in your community or even a community that you travel to. The farmer's market will show a lot, but it won't show everything. Plants are big. There are lots of parts that are edible that we don't usually see. We don't see them at the farmer's market necessarily, although we're beginning to.
There you have it. We're going to take a short break, folks, and we're going to come back and we're going to talk more vegetable literacy and get into southern peas and peanuts.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Keep listening. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Same Old, Same Old by the California Honey Drops on the heritageradionetwork.org.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
I've been walking this same old road. It's the same old road. I've been walking too long.
Welcome back to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. If you like what you hear on Hot Grease or any of our shows on heritageradionetwork.org, we're in the midst of our May membership drive. Go to our website. Become a member. Support us. We're doing great things right here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And we have been chatting with Deborah Madison. Deborah has so many accolades and so many honors. I can't even name them all on Hot Grease. And definitely, hands down, one of my favorite cookbook authors. She is chatting Vegetable Literacy, her new title that's in bookstores. So, Deborah, I want to talk Southern Peas.
I love Southern Peas.
I think a lot of people may not even realize that they have their own little world, Southern Peas.
They do. It's actually a really complicated world, especially if you're not a Southerner and you didn't grow up with them. But to try to get into it and distinguish one from another and this and that gets very, very complicated. That I learned.
Would you say the reason why they're so complex, or not complex, but people don't know about them, is because the origin of the Southern Pea?
I think it's the origin, and I think that there's so many of them. And people, you know, there's common names, there's scientific names, everything gets all mixed up. I talked in the book about reading a paper by an extension director in which he tried to clarify the different classes, and even he said it's pretty confusing and pretty hard to do. But it doesn't matter. Once you have them and to start to grow them, they're really interesting plants, I think.
And you have a gorgeous picture of, you call them Granny Hood Crowder Peas. I didn't even realize that Crowder Peas had a name in front of them, but they're gorgeous. A lot of people may have not seen them before, but they're such a gorgeous pea and a very sweet but not so sweet pea.
Yeah, a lot of these peas are very earthy tasting, and that's what I like about them. But they're really fun to grow because they grow readily. They make these big, long pods, and actually yard-long beans are in the same family as, or genus as, the southern peas. So you can kind of see them going in that direction with these long pods. But the flowers, which are pea flowers, like with black-eyed peas, they're the most beautiful, beautiful flowers. They're sort of mauve, lavender, and yellow. And if you open up the pods before the peas are dried, they're the same colors as the flowers. They're kind of this wonderful creamy yellow with a little purple eye. And then as they dry, they become white and black in what we call black-eyed peas. So it was, I mean, for me, it was really unusual and fun to have access to fresh black-eyed peas and not be in the South, but in the Southwest.
And you have a little side note called Good Companions for Southern Peas. Of course, pork in all forms, but I love the other suggestions that you have there. The harissa, the cumin, also your Meyer lemon. How did you come about these great companions for Southern peas?
Well, you know, peas like black-eyed peas, you actually see them in markets in Greece. And sometimes, you know, in the Mediterranean area, they are from North Africa and Africa, and you know, they moved up to the Mediterranean. So it's not that unusual, if you're in Greece, to find a black-eyed pea dish, and it might be with tomatoes and lemon and capers and olives, you know, those kinds of flavors, rather than what we associate with them with the South, which is mainly pork. So, and it's always a sure bet that a good lemony vinaigrette's going to be good with, you know, any kind of a bean, any kind of a lagoon, because it's fresh and it wakes them up and it goes really nicely with that great earthy taste that they have.
Yes, great, yes. So speaking of botanists, I know you have botanists in your family. Peanuts. When I think Peanuts, the first man that comes to mind, it's George Washington Carver.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and you talked a little bit about him in the book, in your cookbook, and also you did a great job to Peanuts here.
Oh, well, thank you. Now, Carver was interesting. I mean, he came up with, he did so many great things, but one of the things he came up with was 300 ways to use peanuts. And, you know, people came up with that sort of information with soybeans, you know, in more recent times, too. So, you know, he was way ahead of the curve in terms of looking at a legume and seeing all its amazing possibilities. But I love peanuts.
I know. And one of the things that I never really, I don't think I've ever seen, you have you talk a little bit about roasted green peanuts in the shell. I'm like, have I seen that before?
You may not have.
Yeah, how do you, where do you get them? Do they turn a certain color before? Are those the really young peanuts?
Well, no, no. The green just means that they're still fresh and moist and soft. You know, like if you make boiled peanuts, you start with a fresh peanut, not with a dried peanut. So that's what the green refers to, sort of unripe. But no, they're good. They're just really fresh peanuts. And I haven't done this for a while, but you just toss them with oil and some salt and roast them in the oven until they're fragrant. And then you crack those, you know, their shells and get the peanuts out and eat them. Mmm, they're good.
Yeah, I totally have to try that. So, Deborah, I haven't even had a chance to go through, like, every single page in the book. My question is, where should I start next? I went to those two families. I'm like, where should I start? Should I see what's at the market here or what I get in my CSA today and then just go in the index and say,
You could, yeah, sure. That would be one way to use the book and I think a useful way. But otherwise, just start reading a chapter. Let's see. You're in Brooklyn, right?
Correct.
So you're probably just getting spring vegetables, more or less.
Yeah.
So you might take a look at those, like asparagus are in the lily family along with onions, and you could start reading up on that chapter. When summer comes, read up on the nightshades. But I think one of the valuable parts in reading the, not so much the recipes, but the introductions to the families is that you begin to get a sense of how things are related and why they are and what you can do with them in the kitchen, which is feel a little bit more relaxed about mixing things up.
Yes, totally. Deborah, thank you so much for coming on Hot Grease.
Thank you, Nicole. I really enjoyed it.
And for folks who want to check out more about your work, they can go simply to DeborahMadison.com.
Yes, they can. And be sure you try the peanut butter cookies studded with salted roasted peanuts.
Oh, my gosh. I wasn't even going to talk about that. That's like my favorite. I was like, am I going to talk about another cookie recipe? I'm like, oh, should we be talking about vegetables here? More like green stuff and other families. So I was going to bring that up, but yes, I must try that one.
Okay, it's a deal.
Thanks so much, Deborah, and congrats.
Thank you, Nicole.
Listeners, thanks so much for tuning in live to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. Remember, you can join me here every Monday at 3:30 Eastern Time. But until then, always take the road less traveled.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.